Speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight might pick up a blue chip tonight. I think she picked one up a couple of days ago. Her name is Karuna Kay, and she's well loved, and we are so happy to have her. Please give her a very warm welcome, Karuna Kay.
Okay, my name is Karuna, and I am an alcoholic.
Thank you.
Gosh, it's very intimidating. Where do I start? My sponsor is here. Where do I start? Let me begin from the beginning. I guess it would be a good way. As you can see, I'm not from Valdosta, Georgia. I started my art journey on the dark side of the planet called Mizoram. It's in a very remote area of the easternmost part of India. Mountains, beautiful blue mountains, clouds, and it's like a sunwheeler. When I was there about a year ago, I can just look up at the stars, and I can count kind of millions of stars, the galaxy, and I can read. I can read a book in the moonlight, in the full moonlight. So that's kind of like how crazily beautiful it is. I don't know, half of the population at least are alcoholics and drug addicts. So that was really, that's where I came from. I grew up in a very alcoholic family. I was the fourth daughter, and this is kind of like the fourth daughter of seven siblings, and there were five of us girls and two boys. So I was smack in the middle child. And I grew up in a very patriarchal society where, you know, men are highly valued. You know, if you've got a penis, then you're already high up there. And if you're a female like me, and the fourth daughter, not even the eldest or the second, the fourth one, which I'm sure when my mother, you know, had me, we were all born at home, that my parents were not exactly jumping for joy. Oh, another girl. You know, and you know, I've lived with this feeling of being unwanted a long time, like, or being different, and I think that's kind of a common thing among us, but anyway, of course, after 32 years of being married to one wonderful man, many of my abandonment issues and the 20 years in recovery that I have done has kind of like helped with who I am today. And I'm glad to say that I don't have, you know, as many of those issues. And I'm quite comfortable being by myself, being a widow, and you know, doing this kind of work, and really, really grateful. So like I told you, there were seven of us. I have three elder sisters. I was the fourth daughter. Guess what? I guess one of the sisters passed away. Three of them all died. One of them passed away with alcohol-related problems at age 47 in 1996. Then my eldest sister, who actually showed us how to drink, and we all used to drink, and I was only like 12 or 13, she passed away in 1997 with cirrhosis of the liver. And then my other sister, who's a gifted physician, passed away last January while I was there. Luckily, I was there, so I was able to say goodbye to her. That's one of the hardship of adopting a new country, and that, you know, I'm often not there when important things are happening, like death and marriage or birth of children. Anyway, you know. Luckily, like I said, I was there, and I was on a 12-step mission about a year ago. And it has really, that has also been my passion and also my downfall ultimately. And I'll go more into it later on because I want to just tell you a little bit about my early childhood, because it's kind of different, but maybe some of you are also born with chicken running in the house and chicken laying eggs in the house and that kind of a, very hillbilly type upbringing. Up in the mountains where really it's really remote. You know, growing up like that, I didn't know there were any other people. I didn't even see any TV till I was married at age 22. We never had TV, there's no running water, there's no electricity, so we had the light. But, you know, when you don't know what you don't have and you don't miss it, you know, it was just the same thing. I was sharing with somebody tonight that, you know, when I was a child, all I wanted was a really nice mattress and a good stereo system, like 8, 10, when I was trying to beginning to listen to the Beatles on the radio, you know, on the record player. But the record player didn't have that nice boom sound, so I really wanted like a stereo set. And 40 years later, I went home, I still want that. The beds are still hard as a rock. And then there's no stereo system. That's really good. The last time I was there, I bought my own iPod and my own sound system and got that hooked up and also bought the most expensive mattress in the market. So I kind of indulged myself. As a child, you know, I was never physically or mentally abused. I mean, it was just chaotic with 7 children, chicken running, and you know, my mother. You know, it's like chaos. But my earliest memory, I was trying to remember, my earliest memory when I was a baby was this. I remember being really, really cold. I think I was even pre-verbal. I wasn't able. And I was skipping on a very hard surface. I guess that's why I'm kind of like, don't put me on a hard bed. And I was crying and feeling cold and hungry. And I believe that's the experience of fear. That's when it started. I think the meaning of fear is when a child calls, nobody answers. That's fear. You know, that's how I think I got the fear. And you know, it's just like that yucky feeling, like, okay, you know, who's out there? I mean, and it has really impacted. Who can I count on? You know, I still feel sometimes alone. I do. So I grew up feeling unwanted and jealous of my brothers. Definitely relate to Freud with the penis envy. Because my parents really doted on them. They have everything. They get the meat and we just get the vegetables. That kind of a thing. But, you know, I can now look back and I'm okay with that. You know, my parents were good people doing the best they can. Because my brother came within 1 year of me, I was kind of like carted off to my grandparents a lot as a child, and my aunt actually took care of me. But I was never disciplined or spanked. But all hell broke loose in February of 1966, so I was about 11. The measles young people or the measles men rebelled against India and start killing people. We had to flee from the town, and for the next 20 years, Mizoram, my state, was declared a disturbed area, and we had to travel by convoys, and we also, you know, we had curfews. You have to be back in your home by 6 p.m. So that really put so when you go out to party, you have to stay there until the next day. And I guess that's when I get into a lot of trouble too, because you can't go home or have fun trying to dodge the army and kind of like play. You know, it was kind of like a exciting for a teenager to grow up like that, where you're not allowed to go outside at night and kind of like just on a dare. I did a lot of stuff like stealing chicken, you know, like that's like our favorite thing to do. And those are the kind of things we did. So 1996 was a watershed. My elder sister started drinking, so she must have been about, 17, 18? And this was the first time I got... Hi, Trina. I remember it like it was yesterday, the first time I got drunk. I was 12, and my parents had moved me and my other sister, who wanted to become a doctor, to another town, another state. Say, we were in Atlanta, and then they move us up to Charlotte or something like that. That's in another state, so we can go to school. All the schools were closed. So that was my first big drunk, and also it was fairly traumatic the first time I got drunk and I passed out. Later on, that's been my pattern. I now know that those are blackouts, not just passed out, because blackouts, I would still be drinking and talking, but I would not remember a thing the next day. The hallmark of alcoholism. That now, the night that I got really, really drunk, I think my sister and everybody had gone to bed. I woke up in the kitchen by myself with this guy on top of me, this ugly guy on top of me. So, I mean, I was just a child, you know. I was there, you know, a little helpless girl passed out drunk on the kitchen floor. I was really terrified, but because I was just unconscious, I was completely unconscious. So I don't know what exactly happened, consciously I don't remember anything. But later on, my body remembers, and when I see that guy, I think he was a driver of some sort somewhere, my body would kind of react, you know, in a kind of like the yucky feeling kind of comes back to me. My sister came and said, "Oh, are you hurt? Did this guy hurt you?" And then he'd run away by that time. And I couldn't remember a thing. I couldn't remember seemed to also be a pattern with me. I mean, I couldn't remember, you know, and that's always, I couldn't remember what happened when I'm drunk. And usually bad, things happen. It's pretty dangerous when you are drunk and you don't know you're drunk and you continue to drink or drive. And anyway, I want to mention another incident during this, my 12-year-old, 13-year-old. I was babysitting my two niece and nephew. They're about three or four. In Mizoram, we don't have like restaurants, so we have moonshine. We have moonshine places where we go and get drunk. So I took these two little girls to the moonshine place. I was just 13, got really drunk, tried to take them home. I was just staggering all over the road. This was broad daylight. Luckily my uncle was the police inspector, and you know, like I did okay. I mean, you know, it was just another shame I brought on the family. So I was just like this person as a teenager who brought a lot of shame and who has become infamous, I should say, for doing all kinds of things, and I was kind of like beginning to develop that alter ego, like, okay, I'm bad, you know. So that's just the way it is, you know, like, that's just the way. I was very, very rebellious as a teenager. My parents sent me to a boarding school way back, I think that was 1967, 68. They don't want to keep me at home. And this was also kind of a custom for middle-class family in Europe and India to send their children to boarding school. So So I was sent to this nice private boarding school, and then I think I lasted a year. I was kicked out. I was kicked out a lot. I think I was probably trying to sneak out and meet boys who were smoking or drinking. So the boarding school was also in another state, so they sent me home to Aizawl, Mizoram. The schools are not very good there because of the trouble, you know, the political instability, and so when I came back home, you know, I was so unconscious. You know, I was so unconscious in those days. I was just this wild teenager, out of control, wild. When they sent me to the school up in the local school there, and my favorite thing was on Friday afternoon, we don't have classes. We're supposed to do the yard work and clean up the yard. So at that time, when I bring some pot and make everybody stone, everybody. And I was really definitely like the leader of the pack. I mean, I just enjoy getting like drunk and stone and just getting into a trouble. Maybe that was, I was just really seeking attention, but their negative attention, you know, the kind of attention that I got was not good. So that was like ages 16, 19, that really, by that time, I think that was really that should have been my bottom, you know, like hanging out in moonshine places, hanging out with truck drivers, having sex, and at one time I just counted like, God, you know, I have sex with most of the eligible guys in this town. I ran out of boyfriends. So I started having affairs with married men, and I was like 17, 18. So that was pretty, you know. I didn't care what anybody thinks, and that's really like I didn't have the conscience or something to really care. I was just like bad, you know. I was just being bad. That year I completed the 10th grade, equivalent of a 10th grade, and then to everybody's surprise, I passed, because I'd been running away from home, hanging out with drivers, and just being a wild kid. But luckily I passed, and so that's a big like high school, so the next step is college. So I was kind of still college material for some reason. So my parents came up with this Faisal Memorial College in Bombay, a really strict Seventh-day Adventist college where you're locked up, you know, the whole week, and you can go out on Wednesday. So I was sent there. Gosh, poor parents. So I was sent there, and of course I didn't last very long there. I ran away. I think I lasted about 2 months, and I just kind of like skipped town. I don't know. I got on the train and just head back home towards Assam, and telegraphed my parents, said, "Hey, I'm kicked out again, so I'm going to another school here. Send me money." And my parents were like they're the parents just kind of like sending money. The parents are for sending people, you know, children money. That's how I thought. Anyway, so after I came back from there, from that being locked up in that Spicer Memorial College for 2 months, I came to register at the college in this another town, and you know, like I hadn't had sex for 2 months, so I went to this boys' dorm and had sex with the first kid that was there, and I got pregnant just with that one. I got pregnant, so I had my first abortion. I mean, it was like nasty, you know, like it's like, God, this is really bad. This is what happened when you have sex, and oh God, you know, like, and the kid was a student as well, and I was trying to go to school, and we hung together, we split the course, and luckily it was kind of like an okay, you know, like they did the procedure, and we were sent home, and lots of blood, and you know, I now forgive myself for that soul that was supposed to come through me at that time, but my God, I would have made a really bad mother. Children would not have been spared with me at the time. So That's that first abortion, and I think there was another abortion sometime during the next 2 years, because I remember being chloroformed on my face, and it was in Calcutta now. That was another little town, Calcutta, and my parents had sent me to study something else, and you know, they just trying to get rid of me, really, because I caused so much shame, and I was just so wild. The result was like the second time it was like I had a really bad, because I don't even remember who the guy was. So I was in this nursing home type deal, and I got chloroformed, and then they sent me home. I could hardly see. I got chloroform in my eyes and held a bridge, and I was just like staggering and just needing a drink. That's ought to be my, I mean, if that's not a drunk, I mean, I don't know what else. But anyway, so 1973, I was sent to Calcutta to study, and of course, you know, and that's when I kind of like become aware of Mother Teresa, and I was staying in the hostel where there were a lot of people from London, England, to help with her Mother Teresa, and I was kind of like, wow, she's really great, and you know. And I guess, you know, I had started to feel like, God, this is really no way. I woke up like really in a bad mood and just waiting for the next drink, and you know, I'm not going to school, I'm not working, I'm just a slut, you know, I'm just being a slut. So anyway, so 1973, this was all like just happening before I in Calcutta. My parents thought I was studying. Hell no. I found out where I can get hashish and rum and whiskey 24 hours a day. So all of the little black market, and oh my God, my drinking was really uncontrollable. But I was fairly attractive. I was skinny and sexy then in 1972. So I got engaged a couple of times. One guy who wanted to marry me, we went to the discotheque that night. It's called the In and Out. You know, this is the 70s and disco. Dancing, and we started. I was dancing with another guy. He got jealous. This is the macho miso guy, and we just had a drag down fight. I ripped off all of his shirt, and I bit his hand, and he just like, you know, we were just like on the floor, on the disco floor. I don't know who that woman is now, but I guess the engagement was over, you know. I found out later, much later, that he had been married, and he was really physically abusive to his wife, and he would butt out his cigarettes on her arms, and she died. So luckily she died. So that guy was a really monster, and I'm glad I didn't marry him. The other guy I was engaged to at the time, I just won the ring, you know, so I didn't even make it to the engagement party. So I just pawned the ring and I don't know, just like, you know, because I just won the ring. So that's like unconscionable to me now today, like to think that I could do that. And I was just in my disease. I was completely in my disease. I had no moral, I couldn't care less, and I was definitely an out-and-out alcoholic by age 19. Then I met my first American boyfriend in the disco. His name was Steve Williams, and who lives in Singapore. He comes to Calcutta, and I think he was the first man who saw potential in me. Like, okay, here's this crazy kid, and she, you know, she's... See, I guess he just saw the potential, and he kind of like was the first man to just want to talk to me and not have sex, and you know, I'm fine as long as he gave me money. I'm fine just talking. So he said, well, why don't you go back to school? I will support you. I guess he's like a sugar daddy, what you call a sugar daddy these days. And so he got me an apartment to go back to school in New Delhi. So I moved to New Delhi from Calcutta. And it was at this time that I met my future husband, Ron, who was really wild too. I don't know, you know, my late husband, he passed away over 2 years ago, and you know, we were together for 32 years, and so it's been, you know, it's like I know I have to go on, and but the wildness, we had a motorcycle, we travel up to Ladakh and go to the highest highway in the world and go all over Darjeeling, and you know, we smoke pot from the morning and drink chang, the Tibetan, you know, moonshine, and listen to the Stones or Bob Dylan or, you know, one of those, or the Eagles or one of those, and life was pretty kind of calm, you know, like I was completely asleep, I guess. I was not awake, but it was still love. It was still love, you know. I fell in love for the first time, basically. So we got married after 3 months of getting to know each other. We just got married. I realized that, okay, we'll be he's the man that I wanted to be with, and he's Canadian, and so I had torn up all my jewelry, my previous engagement rings, and so we were able to live for another month here, another month there, and we sold the camera, so we were, you know, in India living is cheap. We can, if you sold the camera, we can live there for a whole month, and with the rent paid off and everything. So it was kind of like, those are the 70s. It's kind of innocent, but it was like, I'm glad I lived through that kind of, almost like very innocently, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, that was it. Okay, so we got married in 76, and then we came back to Canada, and he was an engineer, so he got a job, and we kind of calmed down. I still continue to drink and get drunk. Not daily, somehow. I've become like one of those binge drinker. I can not drink from Monday to Friday. Then I was smart. Then I can get drunk all day Saturday and Sunday. Then by Monday I can snap myself back. So high functioning, whatever I have to do. So Ron had a job, and so we were transferred down here in from Saskatoon. We were living in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and we got transferred down here. So those things are just really, really unmanageable. So the next 30 years or so, we kind of settled. The drinking was still pretty much out of control, this is the classic story of how unmanageable life was to when we first moved down here. So we bought a house in Dunwoody with a swim tennis thing, but we couldn't move in there because they had to do something, and we had to stay in this executive suite. And so he said, okay, pack up, and the movers will be there today. And then, so it was like 7:30 in the morning. I was beginning to start packing. Then I saw all of the collection of booze in the fridge, like a little bit of tequila, whiskey, rum. So I said, why pack this? Why don't I just drink them? You know, that would just save me packing. So, you know, it was not very smart, because that was the most horrible day, I think, of my career drinking here. So I already was completely wasted, and I my kids were 2 years old and 5 years old, and they're now 32 and 29. And I was driving from that guest house to find the address where we bought the house. I couldn't find it. Thing, you know, I mean, it was just, I was lost, but I was in the right neighborhood, and I just like knocked down several mailboxes in the neighborhood, and I had the rumor from the neighbors that a drunken Indian from Canada moved in the neighborhood to lock up your children, so to speak, you know. But I said, oh my God, I used to see that all the toppled mailboxes as I passed by. I didn't know it was me, so that was really scary, until the detective shows up. That could have been a bottom for most people, and it kind of like shocked me, and that was 1986, 87, and Ron had given me some AA pamphlets at the time, so I kind of like I had a a very curious mind, and I decided, I was 32, then I decided to go back to school and got an undergrad degree at Georgia State, and you know, I had the luxury of being a stay-at-home mom, and went back and got the in urban studies. I think I was just, you know, like soaking up the information, and graduated with honors. My brain was still working. Then the final denial was stripped off when, and I got into a graduate program at the University of Georgia, Master of Social Work, and guess where I had to do an intern? Decap Addiction Clinic. So I have no idea. God has a sense of humor. So I went there, and it was like looking at a mirror of myself. The clients were all like, oh my God, I'm exactly like them. Oh my God. Maybe I have a drinking problem. So one night I you know, I was already in graduate school, and in November 1991, I said, God, there was about a quarter of whiskey left on the Jim Beam bottle, and I said, well, if I can pour the rest of this whiskey in the sink, that means I am not an alcoholic. But if I can pour it in, and then I am an alcoholic. So I had kind of like, you know, a little stem of my brain was still working, even though I was pretty sauced up by that time, but I was still, part of my brain was still working. And of course I was trying to pour it out, and I just couldn't. And I suddenly came up with another, like, God says thou shall not waste good booze. I just came up with another 10 commandments, add to the 10. So I just guzzled it down, you know. I said, oh my God, I am an alcoholic. And that's when I first called the AA hotline. And I guess I had to admit, concede to my innermost self, I guess that was the first step, that I am an alcoholic. So the AA hotline, you know, referred me to a group called the Georgetown Group, and that's where I start getting sober. It was like a small group, and they meet like three times a week at the Unity Church, and I did not know what to expect. They're only men, and I was feisty as hell, and I hate all of them. And but they keep coming back. You know, read the book, don't drink, read the book. Now that group was very fundamentalist. They are like, if you have, you know, if there's some religious fundamentalists, and those are AA fundamentalists, you can only share, you cannot share about anything else except, how did you stay sober today? And I got that basic. I mean, they were really, really focused. And I'm glad I went there. There was particularly a very obnoxious person there. But today I appreciate where he came from. I mean, he kicked me out of my home group. So we had differences in opinion. You know, but now, you know, I don't have those kinds of issues with anybody. You know, I let you have your own opinion. I don't have to convince you that this is the way. You can be who you are. And I don't expect people to be what I want them to be. They can be who they are. So that's a huge difference. But with this guy, we were just butting heads all the time. I heard that he's one of the reasons that a lot of AA groups started in that area, because they're so obnoxious. So he did some good things. When I first picked up the white chip, for the next 2 years, I think I went to a meeting every day. I was that gung-ho. You know, I'm passionate, so once I hook on to something, then I just, like, overdo it almost. And it's you know, it's like the grace. When I was at any meeting, I hear exactly what I needed to hear. It was almost like the meeting was for me. You know what I mean? Like when you just, oh yeah, that's about, oh yeah. And then, and I went all over, and it was really, really good. It was really, really good. And I got sobriety. I got really sober for the next That was 1991, and then I think I was sober for 9 years. But later on, you know, when I had my dream job at Northside as a psychotherapist, driving the Lexus, and I was just so like, you know, I forgot. So by the time I went to do an outreach, like sort of similar to my downfall earlier last year, my sister had lost her 24-year-old son to a drug overdose. So I said, well, let's go there and support her. So a girlfriend, Peggy, and I went to Mizoram, and again we tried to start AA and for 3 months, and it was just intense, you know, the family crying, and I guess I was not really strong enough. And then when a Russian guy in Bangkok airport said, do you want a drink? I said, yes. You know, so like I just lost it again. But it took me a couple of years to like, okay, does that really count? It was out of the country, and do I really have to pick up another white chip? You know, like, you know, of course I pick up another white chip. So my bottom have been more of the spiritual nature, because, like, you know, I had the car, the two cars in the garage, and my husband loved me, and my kids loved me. And I, you know, it was not. I think as a female, I was pretty much protected by my husband. Whereas a man, I think, you know, you can get nobody there to support you, so you end up in jail or, you know, like whatever. It's a different kind of a bottom. But inside, it's the same bottom. It's pitch black. You know, the heart is just pitch black, and you know, it's just like you're dead. I mean, I feel dead inside. So that's a bottom for me. Let's see. It's what happens to me when I take that first drink. I know what they say about it's the first drink that gets you drunk, you know. And once I have that first drink, and you know, there's no turning back. Do you remember that movie, The Mask? Jim Carrey, when he had the mask, it's just like me after the alcohol, that somebody stop me, and it's just like, you know, like it was just hopeless. I pick up my last white chip a year ago, April 18, and now I kind of like visualize my disease as this king cobra, you know, about 3 feet from me, ready to strike if I make the wrong move, you know. And this past year, I have just thrown myself into the AA beam again. Like I try night flight. I was too embarrassed to come back to Naba because people know me here. So I went to try night flight where they keep the dark, nobody can see you and you can't see anybody. So I picked that group and picked up my white chip and got a sponsor. And that has just been the most transformative year. From that despair to surrender to God, or surrender at peace, or whatever, that I am not in charge, and so like a year ago I was you know, again, I didn't tell you. So anyway, so in Mizoram, the government gave me a grant to translate the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I've been here over 35 years and I don't have a good command of my own language, so I team up with this guy who was an ex-heroin addict and with a motorcycle to help me translate. And we were all the way to employers, and he started relapsing on alcohol. He said, you know, there that the feeling is, if you're a heroin addict, if you're not doing heroin, alcohol is like the lesser of the two evils. It's all right to drink alcohol. So he started drinking. We started drinking about 2 weeks before I left India. It was like April the 9th or something like that. So Mizoram is under prohibition. Alcohol is illegal to sell and illegal to drink and illegal, period. So we spent time trying to find booze and on the motorcycle everywhere. So here I am, the AA Messiah from US, looking for booze at all hours of the morning with this guy. We got the brandy from the army guy and the army headquarters, and he was pretty scary. And then we said we just have to finish before I leave in 2 weeks. Let's just do it. So we completed the translating the big book, drunk as fuck. The chief minister of Mizoram released a big book, just like, you know, it's Mizo language, in June of last year, and of course I need to go back and review it, because we didn't even proofread it. We were just really hopeless. We were completely impaired. But that was then, and this is now. So this past year, you know, I did everything in the 12 step. I got myself a sponsor. And really, really, truly, truly, again, find out how low I could get with the alcohol. I mean, it was just low, and the feeling of despair inside, the hopelessness I felt, the unhappiness, like pitch black, you know, pitch black, like you're dead. You know, I'm dead inside, you know, when I'm drunk. And, you know, I just don't drink, like, just a little bit. I would drink for a couple of days. I'm a binge drinker. So I don't do it halfway either. So the steps. I admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol, and I have a really awesome sponsor who's sitting at the back there. I have a network of men and women in my life now that I can call upon, not just my sponsor. And I do the service work at Triangle. I chair the meeting and I try to be helpful. And Triangle is really a unique place. I just felt that I belong there. And so did a lot of other people who have addiction of all persuasions. Everybody's welcome. And that's what I love about it. Plus, we turn the lights dim when it's time to share. And so I think the sharing in the dark, we are bearing our souls together, and magic happens. Magic happens. So if any of you want to come check out the 10 o'clock, it's really good. This past, I was impaired, so I also have recovery houses called the Red Lotus Recovery, and of course, naturally, I have completely lost interest in that whole recovery houses. Actually, after I came back, I knew I had to work on myself. I knew I can't do anything, and I cannot carry the message if I don't have the message to carry. So I really devoted this year to, you know, healing myself and really doing a thorough 4th step. And being really honest, making amends to my sister in India, where I was the AA Messiah, then I was drunk for like 2 weeks. In fact, that last night I was at home, my boyfriend or whatever thing he was admitted for detox. He was almost dying, and then in order to impress me, he jumped out of a second floor balcony from the hospital. Luckily, he landed in the bushes. So it was just completely chaos, and I was just glad to. I would like to go back and resume. I had hired a full-time staff there because I bought the house for the recovery houses, and he relapsed last September. So I feel like once I get my strength back, I would like to do that. Maybe somebody with somebody like Trina there, right? So anyway, this so that was then, and today, I mean, life is pretty good. Life is really good. I keep close to my network. I go to the meetings. I share. My son is getting married in August at the Henry Ford Museum, and my daughter has a steady boyfriend now, and you know, like, things are looking really good. And I have this angel Jeremy, who's going to be my resident manager, so I can just kind of relax, because it was getting really too crazy 3 weeks ago with that thing. I just can't handle it. I feel like I'm still kind of impaired. I needed to work on myself a little bit. I cannot. I'm not qualified to run a recovery house. I really am not. anyway, so Jeremy's in charge now. Thank goodness. Let's see. I need to stop now, right? So life is good. I'm going to Venice tomorrow, Italy, for a conference on brain that somebody invited me, and I'm very excited about that. And so life is really amazing today. I have hope. I feel freedom. I don't feel bad about myself. I feel like I'm who I am, and I'm okay. You know, I'm really okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Corinna. That was very powerful, and please be safe out there on your journey.
Ah!